I'd like to start out today by opening up the Word. So if you'll join me, I'm going to flip to Mark chapter 4, page 696 in the Bibles that we're sharing here. This story takes place as Jesus is coming to the end of a long run of teaching stops. And he's been walking around with the disciples, telling people the Word, giving them these parables, giving them these images of what his kingdom's going to look like. And then in verse 35 here, we get a break from the teaching. We read that that day, when evening came, Jesus says to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee." And so leaving the crowd behind, the disciples took him along, just as he was in the boat. And there were also other boats with him. When a furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. And Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drowned?" He got up, he rebuked the wind and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." And then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. And he said to the disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" And they were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this, that even the wind and the waves obey him?" Last night, Missy and I got a chance to go out and see the latest of the Batman movies. Always nice to get out to the theater a little bit, and I've really enjoyed this recent run of Christopher Nolan's Batman stories. And what works so well about them to me is this image of a superhero just stuck in a much bigger world that he can't really control. I feel like so many of the great adventure stories we hear, whether they're superhero stories or fantasy stories or just action movies, there's always your hero, and he's got some insurmountable obstacle. And he has to figure out how to climb it or how to break it or how to fight it. But there's something in front of him. There's, you know, something he has to rescue, a person he has to get to, or a villain he has to defeat in a fight. But Nolan, especially in the last two Batman films he's made, it's kind of walked away from that a little bit. And there's some of those traditional elements, but what makes his movies so effective to me is this image of a guy in a storm of chaos. And he doesn't know how to fight it. There's not just someone you can punch hard enough to stop whatever plot is tearing apart Gotham City. There's not one key you can retrieve to make everything go back to normal. It's this one semi-crazy figure out there trying to punch the wind. And it's about as effective as punching the wind. So there's this moment in the latest movie, which I will not spoil for you. We had this just a couple weeks back with a guest pastor at Park Lane who got up and promptly gave away a huge plot twist in Downton Abbey. And didn't affect me, but I heard several oh, moments, including one of the woman sitting next to me. But Anne Hathaway's Catwoman figure at one point says to, in the movie, "You think this can last? There's a storm coming, Mr. Wayne, and you and your friends better batten down the hatches, because when it hits, you're all going to wonder how you ever thought you could live so large and leave so little for the rest of us." It gave a real sense of foreboding to what was to come. Now, the Sea of Galilee, where this story today takes place, is not a place that I know, but I was impressed reading about it a while back to hear N.T. Wright, great theologian and biblical scholar, talk about visiting the Holy Land and going to the Sea of Galilee. And he said, you know, here's this place that's all you hear about in the Bible all the time. There's so much that goes on in the Sea of Galilee, but what got me there wasn't the history or anything so much as the parking lot. Because there's this sign And the parking lot's up from the water, just normal looking place. But they felt a need to erect this little marker warning you that if you came, left your car, and walked away, you were leaving it to the hands of fate. Because storms can come up so quickly that the water has apparently on numerous occasions simply sloshed up, taken cars, and dragged them into the sea, only to leave hapless tourists stranded. I didn't know that bodies of water, landlocked bodies of water, non-oceans could do that, but apparently it's enough of a threat that they had to put up signs. And it just called to my mind how much of these frightening sea moments we come across when we start reading through the Bible. Because this is far from the only one. Jonah goes out in the ocean, and his ship is nearly wrecked, and he's thrown into the water and taken into the depths by a whale. The Israelites have to cross the sea to escape the Egyptian army, and once they're safely across, God wipes out the most powerful military force in that part of the world in a heartbeat with a little bit of water. The creation story begins when God creates a bubble separating water from water and creating a haven for life to thrive. And throughout the Psalms, more than anywhere else, you can hardly get five verses without coming across references to the sea. The sea, it's not just water in this world. The sea was this figure, Yom. And if you've ever wondered why it was that you read those Old Testament stories and the people of Israel are always walking away from their God and going to worship Baal, Baal is their savior because of the sea. Yom, his little brother, is everything that scared the people of that world. Because while Baal was the one who brought order and new life, raised the crops from the ground, took care of you when you were scared, Yom was the one that wanted to unravel it all. He's chaos. He was the breaking of the world, the undoing of everything. And while death might have been scary, death was at least something that brought you into the underworld, gave you a new life. It wasn't someplace you wanted to go. But Yom, the sea, that just went on forever. And if you fell out of your boat, you didn't just float to the bottom and wash up on the shore. You just kept going down and down into the cold black. The book of Daniel, the sea is where monsters come from. So in this little story, Jesus and his disciples are out on the water, and they're floating on a little piece of wood above that black. And Jesus comes up, and he stills it in a word, and the disciples are left with this one question ringing in their ears. Who is this man? What we see in this story is, in concrete terms, what all the parables earlier in chapter 4 are getting at. These images that Jesus is giving can't convey with quite as much power what's shown in this moment on the water, that Jesus is the Son of God. He is the one who's come to still to take charge of all things. And there were three things in the ancient world that were really scary. Nature, death, and the spirit world. Those were the things you couldn't understand, the things they veils, you didn't know it was on the other side. And so now one comes along, like Daniel 7, Son of Man, with an authority and a power that terrifies these disciples. It's the power of God himself. I always try to put myself in the shoes of the people in these stories. And so I was looking for an image with this, and I got to thinking about all the times I've gone hiking, which is one of my favorite pastimes. And I'm guessing any of you here who've ever hiked have also hiked with someone who's not good at hiking. That doesn't mean they're slow or weak, but there are people who just don't have the mindset for it. And you usually know them far too late in the game to just turn around and go back home. but with plenty of time left that you're going to hear all about it. And the sound of a human whine is just, I don't know, it's like it's just hardwired into our brain. This is the exact tone of voice to drive someone to madness. So I was just picturing myself walking along on one of the hikes that I've had the misfortune of taking with a whiner. And the weather starts to turn bad, and the rain's coming in, and you just hear them going behind you. Come on, are we there yet? I'm cold, I'm tired, I'm wet. On and on, mile after mile, until finally you just turn and stop it! There's nothing else to do. Imagine if it actually did. What would it be like to see clouds just pull back? Because I've known a lot of people with amazing talents, and I feel like we're kind of fascinated by that. There's all these television shows that are built around finding hidden talents. But when a friend, someone you've known for a long time, busts out something that you didn't know they could do, it's got a lot more oomph. To see someone with the power to change the sky, I don't know. I feel like modern audiences really struggle with these big nature miracles. I mean, it's just too weird to think about, at least for me most of the time. I mean, to change a weather pattern, just too many flitting little particles moving around through the air, all of them getting redirected and spun. The effects are too broad. You know, I can deal with healing miracles because that's kind of isolated. It's just one person, and God can reach in there and change it. But a weather pattern, that affects huge regions of the world. It's just too big. And so I think a lot of us want to take stories like this, and preachers are especially guilty of this, and take the storm out of it. Take the miracle aspect and turn this into an allegory, if you will. You know, storms, it's not made out of driving rain and thrashing wind and all of that energy. Storms are the stress we feel, the pain of sorrow, broken relationships, trying to figure out where we're going to get rent money for next month. You know, God can heal the heart. Let's focus on that, because that's what really matters to us a lot of the time. That just makes it too easy to not think about what's going on in this story where he wipes clean the skies as well. There is some precedent for that. If you flip over to the Matthew 8 account of this same miracle, that's kind of the direction that he goes. In Matthew's version, this is a story about community. This is a story about the disciples asking Jesus for a little bit of deliverance, and Jesus giving them just that. They come and say, "Can you save us?" And he says, "Sure, and I always will." But we're in Mark, and Mark lets things stay chaotic. He leaves the disciples with those psalms echoing in their heads, that terror of Yom below them in the silence when the wind has died. Teaching faith in Jesus wasn't enough. There's more to his work here. And if I was going to be back next week, I would use this to lead into a text like Colossians 1, that brilliant hymn that the Apostle Paul writes, where he starts talking about Jesus and refers to him as firstborn of all creation, creator of all things, all thrones and powers and authorities, the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, the image of an invisible God on earth. The Jewish dream that Jesus is here to fulfill is one of peace over all the creation. Unlike, say, the Jonah story, Jesus doesn't need to get tossed overboard to appease an angry God to still the sea. He carries that authority inside of him. This is the power of a creator God, one for whom no storm is of any consequence. This is the guy who, back in the beginning, John tells us, was the Word through whom everything was made, who flicked stars out of his fingertips. There's this great phrase I love whenever I'm looking up and thinking about the heavens, the stars. It's the wastefulness of creation. This idea that God made so much more than he needed to. And it almost boggles the mind to think why that he would keep going, spinning off galaxies. And yet, he did. And it really puts our storms in a little perspective. What we have here is a fulfillment of Psalm 107, the promise that God is the one who can still the seas. And you remember those three great fears of the ancient world earlier? Nature here, but the next two stories, Jesus heals a man possessed of a demon and raises the dead. Nature, the spirit world, and death itself. All right here in this story. And so the disciples ought to have everything they need to trust in this man they've been walking with, but they don't know that yet. All they know at this moment is that they are in absolute terror. Their life is probably coming to an end. And Jesus, this guy who's talked about love, who's walked with them through all these villages, who sat with them, ate with them, slept with them, is sleeping through their darkest night. And so they wake him up, and he turns around, and he doesn't comfort them. Instead, he slaps them across the face with this question, "Where is your faith?" Many of you have ever dealt with people in extreme stress. You might, like me, might be a little bit surprised that he doesn't get punched in the face in that moment. Now, nature is still a scary thing, but I don't think it's scary enough to us to really appreciate this story anymore. I mean, we live in pretty good homes, most of us. We don't have to spend time out underneath stormy skies, usually unless we want to, or plan poorly on a hike. But there have been three times in my life that I've been fully terrified of the natural world around me. And the off chance you guys want to invite me to come back again, I certainly won't waste all of those stories here, but I think I can pass one out. So I came on top of a place called Flat Top Mountain. I was working in Glacier National Park for a summer, and it was called Flat Top Mountain because huge flat top. About a half mile long, a couple hundred yards wide of just empty stone. No trees, no little mounds, nothing but an empty space and three lonely hikers. And those of you who spend any time in the mountains may know that early afternoon is when weather shifts up in the hills, and it's when the storms come in. And if there's one place you probably don't want to be when lightning storms start to form, it's as the only tall thing on top of a giant, flat, empty surface. And being 6'5", with a couple of short little friends, I was certainly the highest thing around at this moment. To compound that, we had been climbing up some icy chutes, which meant we had ice axes with us. It's a really useful little tool, about 3 feet long, made of aluminum with a little spike at the end. And they're kind of a pain to carry when you're not in the snow, so most backpacks will have a little loop right here, and you put the axe in, and then you flip it up and lash it. So now all of a sudden you've got a little aluminum spike over your head as you're walking. There's this funny little thing that happens when electricity starts to build up and you've got an aluminum pole sticking up over your head. You start to hear little insects buzzing around your head. It's actually the aluminum vibrating faster and faster as the charge builds up. First time I heard it, I didn't really know what was going on, but once you come to recognize it, it's a little bit of a self-preservation instinct that kicks in. And in that moment, all I can recall is wanting nothing in the world so much as to get out of where we were. And we threw our backpacks and we ran. There was no stopping to think. There was no stopping to pray. God didn't even come into my mind. All I could think about was getting away from nature. being on a wide open flat surface. Gave me several seconds to think about that. We got down. We got off the ledge among the trees, but that fear stuck with me, that tight little grip around their chest. And I think the disciples must have been feeling something pretty similar to that in this story. And I see Christians regularly with this burden that comes from having moments of doubt. I wasn't proud after the fact that I had no sense of turning to God when I heard that buzzing behind my head. Just wasn't there. And I kind of wondered, you know, on the one hand, doing the safe thing, getting away from the lightning, but shouldn't I have been praying while I was running? What was wrong with my faith? And for a lot of people going through crises, this can turn into a real issue. We wonder, why don't I trust God more? Why don't I turn to Him? Is that the problem? Is God not helping me because I don't love Him? Because I won't put my faith in Him? Because I'm still clinging to other plans, other options, trying to get myself out of this? And this manifests deep down. It's a feeling of inadequacy. I know so many folks who love God deeply, but still feel like there's something wrong with them because of that question, why can't I just fill in the blank? Why can't I just trust Him? Why can't I just have peace? Why can't I just be better, more loving, more faithful? This can be especially threatening these days. Let's look at the stats, and there's going to be 115,000 new people added to the taken off the unemployment rolls this summer. Not because they found jobs, but because their benefits are just going to run out. Safety net's done, and that's it. And the long-term consequences of things like unemployment aren't just financial. It gets really deep into people spiritually, too. It stresses them out individually, starts to form cracks in family units. Depression rates skyrocket. Divorce rates skyrocket among the long-term unemployed. There's new research going on about how much heart disease can be linked to stress, especially financial stress. And though I cautioned earlier against personalizing stories like this, there's room for that too. That stress just drove a woman in our congregation last week to take her life. Lost one of our daughters. Preachers can walk into these situations and make them worse by insisting that if we just had enough faith as a church or as Christians, God would banish all of our storms for good. But we live in a world that's still totally cracked and run through with sin. It's a broken place. And we believe as Christians that evil's been defeated, that Christ came and that God has won His victory, that He's in control, but there's still this shrill malevolence to sin in the world. And Mark's readers, the people to whom this book was written, knew better than most that Christians weren't protected from all harm. These were people who couldn't get work, often because of their faith, who were mocked, who were at times physically assaulted, and at other times even killed, despite their faith. And because of it. And so Mark invites us through this text to call out to Jesus, not just in our faith, but also in our fear and in our anger and in our pain. But strangely, the calm that comes after the storm clears doesn't preclude fear. Well, C.S. Lewis once said that it was clear to him that any good book needed to be read or reread at least every 10 years or so. I've got some books that I reread every 2, maybe because my memory's not as good as his, but maybe I just like them. But there's something to be said for coming back to a story again and again. If you have kids, might know this too well, rereading the same book every night for months on end. But rereading this book of Mark, it becomes pretty clear to me that this story right here, this little 7-verse snippet about the storm is really a microcosm of the entire gospel. You have Jesus and their disciples going about their business, and the disciples don't know it's coming. They don't know this storm is on its way. It's sudden, and it suddenly strikes them on the boat. But there's also echoes of months later in Jerusalem when a storm's brewing around the Feast of the Passover, when the disciples are there, but there's also conversations going on in the synagogues, whispers, betrayal, soldiers already marching, a trial underway, getting set. And while Christ is asleep in the hold of the ship, seemingly oblivious, we can also see him after that trial hanging on a cross, sleeping in death. And both times, the disciples have to deal with this question of fear. Because the storm abates on the sea, and a tomb sits empty by the power he has over death. And each time, fear turns, not to relief alone, but also to terror, as they are confronted with this idea that the man they thought they knew isn't just the man they might have thought they knew. Their deliverance from the storm, their deliverance from evil, from sin, it doesn't come from faith, great faith, even adequate faith. It has to come from this person of Jesus. That's something that's already done. And nothing the disciples could do, and nothing we do or fail to do, can change any of it. Salvation is one thing, and it's a great thing, an incredible thing. But there's a second lesson in this story. It demands that we pay attention. So Jesus is not just greater than this storm in his power. Because if we just wanted to talk about power, that's fine, but it's not enough. Power speaks to many of us in significant ways, but the response to that can come from that heart of stone that we were reading about in Ezekiel. You know, that's firm. It's a big thing. But that text we read from Ezekiel 36 promised a heart of flesh. And we believe that we are made in God's image and that Jesus came and was one of us and had that heart of flesh as well. And that means that in addition to his power, he was a man and a man of love. And struggling to reconcile those things, that this is a man of limitless power, tough enough to wipe out or control or create anything we can even imagine and more, is also the one who comes to us in love and wants to know us, wants to hug us, wants to hear our story. It's a huge cognitive step, and it's a huge step of the heart. When we read this gospel, when we read the story of this storm, we read the story of Christ on the cross, we hear that we ought to know that there is a love that can conquer our fear. But like the disciples, most of us aren't there yet. And so for the time being, Mark says, we can pray out of whatever we are feeling. Pray out of love, pray out of your fear, pray out of your anger, pray out of your confusion, pray out of your hope. Just pray. Jesus will hear. And there's no threat that can withstand just a single word out of his mouth. But with this testimony before us, we also shouldn't be surprised if, when the storm blows itself out, he turns to us and asks us, and we're going to get some real faith. That hard faith birthed not out of just accepting his might, but also his love, the love he promises that can cast out all fear. Amen. I would love to pray. God, Father, Creator, so many words, so many names you have, so many things to try to understand about you. It's just overwhelming sometimes. I just want to thank you for inviting us to wrestle with that, for inviting us over and over again to try to get to know you, to try to learn to trust you a little better, for promising that our faith isn't in vain, no matter how strong or how weak, that you want it, that you want our prayers, and that you want to walk with us as we come to know you, that you want to love us. Help us to feel your love. Help us to know your love. And teach us each day a little bit more to love you in return. Amen.